Recovery is definitely easier with this, man. Thank you for all the good times, Frank, bad times, and whatever else fucking happened these last couple of years knowing you. Frank K.
Thanks, Mark. I just blanked out. Yeah, Frank, alcoholic drug addict. 29 years ago. Today was day one. I'm still letting people in. Yeah, I'm like Mark said, I'm a great grandfather. I was at the park with my great grandson yesterday, and there was a couple that were older than me with a little one running around named Henry. So Henry and Ace were playing together. And they said, "Are you the father?" And I said, "No, I'm a great grandfather." And I know they were the grandparents, and here I am, a great grandfather with a grandson who is older than the child they're watching, And so they were pretty shocked. But I'm really grateful for all that. I could go on for forever about my gratitude here. Just the family I've been a part of, and really the recovery I've been a part of through the years. Yeah, I grew up in Ohio, up on the coast of Lake Erie. Just stats. My parents divorced when I was like 11 or 12. I moved in with my mother because I was living with my three brothers and my father, and we were living on like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And my mom invited me over to this real nice meal, and she said, "I want you to come live with us." And I based that decision solely on the quality of food that was going to be available. So I moved in with my mother, and within 2 weeks of moving to this new town, I was brought home by the police. And that was a recurrence throughout my childhood. I was just always getting in trouble with the police. I never really felt, we bounced around quite a bit growing up, and I never really felt like I fit in anywhere. And even in my own family, I didn't really feel a part of. And I was subjected to a lot of, looking at it now, it's almost ritualistic abuse from my brother's torture, really. And I found out years later why. Lying, cheating, and stealing was just something I naturally came into. And a lot of that was because of them and their just emulating them. They were liar, cheats, and thieves, and gamblers, drinkers, drug addicts, high-speed drivers, adrenaline junkies, womenizers. And these were my role models. These are the people I looked up to. These are the people I thought were cool. And I didn't know any better. I wasn't really exposed to anything other than that. And but I was severely neglected as a child as well. Just didn't get a lot of personal care. And it's like my neighbor would take me to the barber shop to get my hair cut because she would see me come out of the house with my big bush of a head of hair, and she would say, "Let's go get your hair cut." And, it was that kind of stuff. There was just nobody really looking after me. And as a young teen, I was on my own and running the streets and getting in trouble. And, and then my brothers exposed me to smoking weed when I was really young. I was mixing drinks at family parties, like 10 years old. There's pictures of me in tuxedos at weddings that I know I was drunk at, even when I was like 3 foot tall, just a really small kid, in this little powder blue tuxedo. And I remember getting yelled at for getting grass stains on the tux because I was drunk and running around. But I loved the effect of alcohol and drugs. I just loved it. Somebody mentioned it not too long ago. They said, when I smoked weed, it took me to another world. And to me, it was like I was already in my own little world, and then the weed and alcohol just made that little world better. Because, like I said, I never really felt connected to anybody. So I was very problematic as a juvenile. I did really well in school as far as testing and intelligence goes. I took advanced math courses and tested really well. But my behavior, my alcohol and drug use, I'd always rather be under the influence of drugs and alcohol. That was just, and it wasn't like don't ever remember running from feelings or doing it because of this or doing it because of that. I just really liked being under the influence, and I tried to stay there all the time. Like through high school, kept a bottle of cough medicine in my locker, and I drank cough medicine throughout the day because the kids that drank alcohol at school got in trouble. But the kids, but me drinking the cough medicine, I never got caught because you couldn't really smell it, So that's just how I survived high school. Somehow I managed to graduate. I had gotten in so much trouble. My granddaughter just recently failed her driver's test, and I remembered that I wasn't allowed to get my driver's license because my license was suspended before I ever got it for running from the police on my dirt bike. And they caught my buddy, and he turned me in, but they suspended my license before I could even get it, so I wasn't allowed to get it for 6 months. And but that was the kind of stuff. It was just, I was just out having fun, and I was in a small town with too many police. They just kept interfering with me having fun and me doing my thing. And there was a group of us, it wasn't just me. There was a lot of us that had alcohol and drug issues for sure. Some of my friends started going off to rehab at this time, and I was always there to welcome them back to the world when they got out, to get them high and, we missed you. Come on, let's go get them wasted. And I got my first DUI in my buddy's car. I was driving through a bunch of lawns and tearing up the grass. We used to call it turf and lawns. And I got caught, and they suspended my driver's license, and I had to go to AA meetings. I had to go to three a week, I think. And then I had to go to outpatient treatment. And at this point, I knew there was something definitely wrong with my drinking. I remember vividly being at the beach one night, and I was drinking this beer, and I could hear this little voice in my head saying, "You don't need this. Why are you drinking? You're already buzzed." And it just never, I could never get a handle on it. I could never, it was like I was on autopilot all the time, just taking whatever came along. And I did a lot of household chemicals, paint and gas and glue and whatever I could get my hands on, just to get, keep the buzz going or keep it, whatever. Anyway, so I got in this trouble, and I had to go to AA meetings, and here I was, I have a family of alcoholics and drug addicts. So, and then I come into a room full of alcoholics in recovery, and it was just like culture shock. And I just could not, it was like a whole nother world to me. It was like going from America to a foreign country. It was that black and white for me. And, the people welcomed me, and they seemed to really genuinely interested in my welfare, which was totally foreign to me. I'll never forget this guy, Ernie. I was in there getting my slip signed and just staying in the back of the room, not talking to anybody. And Ernie caught me on my way from getting my slip signed because I was a quarter to AA, so I had to get this little paper signed at all the meetings. I don't know if they do that in Europe. But anyway, so I'm coming back from that table, and Ernie shakes my hand, and I did the traditional looking at the floor, shook his hand and went to turn away, and he said, "How are you, Frank?" And I said, "Oh, I'm fine, And he didn't let go of my hand. And I was trying to walk away, and he just held me there, and just, and he, I was forced to look up at him. And he's like, "No, Frank, really, how are you?" And it just cut through. It was like, it was undescribable, the experience for me. How it touched me. But here was this guy that was really interested and really concerned. And that, that really changed everything for me. I really identified, I got a copy of the Big Book, and got a sponsor, and I was making coffee, and I had a good crew of young people that were sober at the time, and we were all running the meetings and having fun. And I identified myself as an alcoholic in that Big Book. Like, we just read the Jaywalker story at a meeting last night, and I was the Jaywalker. That made total sense to me. That, and not thinking about the consequences before picking up a drink, that was totally my MO. I never, there wasn't even a thought of what might happen if I drank, even though all my experiences proved that once I start, I can't control it. Once I start, I can't tell you what's going to happen. I mean, it could be a nice fun night. I could be an emotional crybaby, or I could be the rageaholic, breaking windows, breaking street signs, breaking light posts. It was all hit and miss. I was Jekyll and Hyde. It was really, and I'm watching all this happen in my head, just trying to figure things out. And of course, I don't have anybody to talk to, in my family. So, I don't know, that was all. It's really hard to focus on any one thing that happened. There was just so much going on at that time. I had signed up to go in the service. My dad was a life Marine, so I was going to be a Marine, and I was going to get out of this small town and get away from these cops. And the Marines were going to straighten me out. They were going to take care of all my bad discipline, my bad behaviors, and they were going to whip me into shape. And that was like the most important thing in my life at that point, was getting out of town and getting away from all this, getting away from the police. And so I quit smoking weed to pass a drug test to get in the military. And then I was trying to quit drinking, and I was really having a hard time with it. So I basically just stopped hanging out with everybody I hung out with, and went to meetings and hung out with those people, and that really worked. And one night my two buddies picked me up, and they had a 15 pack of beer in the truck. And they were both going in the military too. We were all shipping out around the same time. And I said, "No, not tonight. I'm not drinking." And I lasted about 15 minutes in the truck with two guys drinking beers. I could say no for about 15 minutes, and then I was like, "Oh, fuck it." And we ended up getting arrested, all three of us. We got out, and now I'm 18. I had just turned 18, so it was no more juvenile court. It was no more juvenile offenses. It was serious jail time I was looking at. Yeah, so now I'm suicidal. I told my gunny, the enlistment guy, that I got arrested again. He said, "Frank, we don't want you." So now my ticket out, the Marine Corps, is no longer a ticket out. So now I'm stuck in this situation in this town. And the only thing I want to do is drink, and the only thing but I know I can't. And so I'm really, I mean, I had made a mess of everything so far that I thought, it would be, I'd be better off dead. My family would be better off without me. That whole kind of thinking, and it was very serious. And so I had this plan, and I was going to this outpatient treatment, and I had to see this woman named Becky. And I was just pretending that everything was okay. I was just trying to get through to this day when I had planned to do it. And for some reason, I walked in this lady's office, and I just broke down and told her, I was suicidal, and everything that had happened that I hadn't told her about. And just, everything came out, and she really saved my life, and I'll never forget her. And she ended up leaving the field shortly after. She was no longer a counselor. I went back to see her years later, and she was no longer there. But yeah, so I started getting really serious about AA. I got sober in August of 86, I believe. Might have been 85. I'm not sure. But anyways, I'm going to meetings. I find a home in AA. I'm really comfortable. And once I got completely clean, everything turned around. I was hopeful. I was happy. I was strong and healthy, and really active in AA, and active with all these young people. We were going to conferences, and just really good fellowship. And we had AA softball teams and AA picnics, and it was a whole different kind of AA back in the 80s. And just really, really good. And then I met this girl at a meeting. She came in, and she walked in. I can tell you the meeting I was at. It was a Tuesday night, and she walked in, and she had this golden aura around her. And there she was, the girl of my dreams. I met her at an AA meeting, and just like out of the big book or whatever the story is. And yeah, and so we started dating, and she got pregnant, and then I, she told me. And to tell you the kind of family I came from, my mother, when I told her what was going on, she offered me money to get out of the country and to get out of town and to leave this girl alone with this with my child. And so that was just how we rolled. But I was an AA and I wanted to do the right thing, so I stayed and stuck, and we started having babies. And I had like a little nervous breakdown in the beginning. I was working like 8 hours a week, living in my mom's basement, riding my dirt bike every day, and going to meetings at night. And all of a sudden, I'm going to be a dad, so I have to get a job and I have to get an apartment and have to become a responsible person. And we, it all fell into place. And, my daughter was healthy, and it lasted about 22 months, I think, the first time. And I'm working 60 hours a week now, and I'm not going to as many meetings. I have a newborn, and I think at that point, or it might have been coming up. I may not have had her yet. I don't really remember. The whole time period is really blurry. But my brothers are going to Indianapolis for the Indianapolis 500, and they go to the time trial every year. And we rode motorcycles down from Cleveland to Indianapolis, and my father would ride his motorcycle up from Oklahoma to Indianapolis, and we would all meet there. It was like an annual thing. And somehow I talked myself into partying. I just thought I could do it one weekend out of the year. I'll be out of state. I'm gonna go get high with my brothers and party, and I'll be in Indiana and nobody will know, and I'll come back and be sober again. Everything will be fine. I'll just get all this stress out of my life. And so that's what I did. And I was high before I ever left town. We were in a gas station, and I can tell you the gas station. It's in North Olmsted, and before we got on the highway, I was high with my brother. And so I partied all weekend. Same stuff always happened. I got drunk and threw up and passed out, and I came back, and I came back to AA, and it wasn't the same place. I was carrying that big secret, not telling anybody, and it wasn't because it had become a real safe place for me. It was really my life in those meetings, and that was all shattered somehow. So I grabbed my sponsor and I said, "Hey man, when I went to India, I got high," and he said, "I got a bag in the car." So here's my sponsor. Had been smoking weed this whole time and I never knew it. So I call him my pot smoking sponsor. And out of all the people I knew in AA at that point, I picked the wrong guy to tell that I got high, because me and him just started smoking weed all the time. And so my wife thought I was going to meetings, and me and him were getting high and going golf, and me and him getting high and going to the movies. And I stayed away from drinking for a long, long time because I knew it was an issue for me. But I figured I could smoke weed, and then I got a cold, and that old friend cough medicine came back, and I got physically addicted to cough medicine very quickly, and I was drinking it like I drank everything, like I did everything. And it was funny. My son's got 15 years sober, and he called me a couple of years ago, and he's like, "Hey, Dad, wouldn't it be great just to get high once in a while?" And I was like, "Well, wouldn't you rather get high all the time?" And he's like, "Well, yeah." And I said, "Well, that's the problem, because there is no once in a while for us. It's all the time, And it's just funny how that the disease come at you with those simple little ideas, like, can't you just do it once in a while? And the reality is what the reality always was, because it was never once in a while. It was always all the time. Yeah, so I got physically addicted to cough medicine, and was doing that for a long time, and people were noticing. I'd be at work and people would come up to me and say, "Are you okay? Because you're sweating terribly, and you look awful." And I'm like, "Yeah, I just have a cold, But my pot smoking sponsor took me out to a bar one night, and I got this little medicinal bottle of cough medicine in my pocket. And I said, "You know what? This is silly. I'm drinking this little bottle of Robitussin, and I might as well just have a drink." And I said, "Well, give me a rum and coke." And it was like I never fucking stopped. Everything changed completely. There was no restriction. There was no hesitation. There was no, it was like that was the one thing that was keeping me somewhat sane, was not drinking. And once I took that away, I was completely insane again and completely back to it. And I came home and I announced to the family that I was drinking again. My brothers welcomed me back. It was so nice to have me back partying again. Even my father-in-law, who was a really rigid, strict guy, he's like, "I think Frank should be able to have a beer after he gets off work. I think that's okay." And here's my wife, who knew me from AA, and she's like waving her hand saying, "No, Frank drinking is not a good idea. You guys don't understand. This is not a good thing. Don't support this." And I continued for, I was out for 7 years, and And at the end, and I knew I was an alcoholic, a drug addict. There was never much denial in my life. I always knew there was an issue. I always knew that I was different. I always knew that alcohol affected me not like other people. I couldn't do it like other people did. And being an alcoholic made total sense when I came in. I was like, oh, that makes sense. This is my problem. So once I started drinking again with a full knowledge of AA and the disease and the whole thing, I knew exactly what was going on. And I knew I was getting progressively worse. And I knew I was physically addicted. And there was no thought of, hey, I should stop. Hey, I should try AA again. I just didn't care anymore. I was drinking myself to death because that's what my disease says. Stay alone, stay by yourself, drink yourself to death. And so that's what I was doing. And we had gotten in an argument, my wife and I, and over my daughter's birthday party. And I had set out and well, I got a couple bottles and came back, and she had called the police. And I was growing pot in my basement. And it wasn't just a little pot, it was a lot of pot, and it was really smelly. And so as soon as you open the side door, you could smell a pot through the whole house. And I had three kids by this point, and I don't want to go to prison, and I don't want to get the kids taken away. So I leave. I'm like, I'm not going to deal with the police in my house. I'll deal with the police out on the road, where they won't smell the pot that's growing in my basement. And so, but I have a motorcycle, I got a pickup truck, and I decided to take this bicycle because I don't want any legal problems. I'll take a drunken disorderly or a public intox. That's okay. I'll deal with that. My family will understand that my wife called the cops and broke the family code. That whole fucking sick thinking way of life that we lived in. So yeah, the police come and they're chasing me on this bicycle and they're talking to me out the window. They got the lights and the sirens going, and I'm trying to run away on my bicycle. And they're going, and it's this lady policewoman, and she's going, Frank, we just want to talk. And I'm like, oh, no. And they're like, no, we're concerned about you. Your wife is very worried about you, and we just want to talk. And I said, so you promise you won't arrest me if I stop? And she said, yeah, I promise. So I stopped, and she promptly arrested me and took me to jail. And they charged me a DUI and a bicycle, which I didn't know you could do. So they took my driver's license away again. And apparently Ohio had changed the code and just word removed the word motor out of the motor vehicle code. So it was any vehicle. So now it's not just me having trouble in my personal life. It's me having problems in my professional life because now I'm gonna have to tell my work and I no longer have a driver's license. And they've been questioning me about my drinking as well. There was a few occasions where the secretary said, do I smell alcohol on you? And I would just say, no, I was just from drinking the night before. And that passed as many times as I could. But now it's all on the open. So, and AA is the last place I want to go. They want to send me back to those meetings at court. And I said, don't send me back to those meetings, just send me to jail. And they think, well, no, AA is really the best place for you. It worked really well the first time. You stayed sober the whole time. You were attending meetings last time, so we'll give you 7 meetings a week for a year. So that was my new probation. So I had to go to 7 meetings a week for a year, and that's how I got sober. AA pulled me back in, and this was the last place I wanted to go. And that's what, if there's really anything about my story, it's the thinking of alcoholism. It's the thinking, because AA was the last place I wanted to go. I did not want to come back here. I would rather drink myself to death then come back here, knowing what I knew, And once I got sober again, and I tapered off, it took a long time to get off. I was really physically addicted. And once I tapered off and my thinking cleared, I was like, man, that the sober time I had the first time was the best time of my life. It changed the trajectory of my life. It gave me three beautiful kids and gave me the hope that I needed the very first time because I was on my way out at 17, my life was over. And that's the thing about alcoholism. That when I take a drink, my thinking changes completely. I am no longer I'm not the person sitting here. I am an alcoholic that's going to continue drinking until it's over. It's like I get on a roller coaster and I don't get done until the ride's over. And that's my drinking. Yeah, so I went to my old home group, Lakewood Men's Beginners, and it was a Monday night, and I left that meeting. I went home, and I had a quarter ounce of good, really good green Bud, and I flushed it all down the toilet. And that was my sober date, 29 years ago. And that was the first time I ever wasted anything. I never threw out drugs. I never dumped alcohol down the drain. I would drink the warm beer I passed out with the night before that was flat, rather than throw it out, because I knew I was just going to throw it up anyways. My morning drink was over my sink because I knew I was going to throw it up. That was, it's like people that know late stages of alcoholism, I don't have to explain all that to. And but it was pretty fucking horrific. And the thing that was making me sick was the only thing that made me feel better. And that's the cycle I was stuck at, day after day, hour after hour. Eating wasn't even, I would eat like half a meal a day, and I would just drink around the clock and wake up and drink and pass out. And it wasn't, I wouldn't even call it sleeping. It was just passing out and coming to and drinking and passing out. Yeah. So, it somehow, AA pulled me back in and got me sober again. And I went to that meeting with 6 days sober. And then I went to that meeting with 13 days sober. And then I went to that meeting at 20 days sober. And I never left that first step table until probably 6 months. And I went to lots of meetings. Like I said, I was on probation. I had to go to 7 meetings a week for a year. And it worked, Physically, I had to go through a lot. There was a lot of rebuilding that my liver had to go through. It was swollen when I went to the doctor 3 months sober, and I didn't tell him anything about drinking or anything. I just wanted to get checked out. And he said, your liver's enlarged. And I said, oh yeah, I quit drinking 3 months ago. And he said, well, it'll get better. That's one of the few organs that does recover. And I'll never forget, he said, when you think about drinking, Frank, you should talk to your wife. And I said, no, you don't understand. When I talk to my wife, I think about drinking. But there was a lot of people out there that doesn't really understand the disease and didn't understand alcoholic thinking. And I think we've made leaps and bounds, especially within the last Zoom years of spreading information and what's really true and what works and what doesn't work. And yeah, so I got sober again, and then I went through and I got busy. I was made coffee for years. I was chairman for years. I was secretary for years. I had two home groups Monday and Thursday. And I was the type of guy that needed a lot of meetings. That's what I needed to do to stay sober. I needed to keep my thinking straight. And this is where my thinking gets straight. It's not sitting on the couch by myself. This is where I have to come to get back in fucking tune. Because on my own, I'm a fucking mess. I got divorced at 5 years sober. I mean, really, it was just all good AA. I brought my kids up in meetings. I was a single dad, so I would bring my kids, and they would sit in the back and color, and they had donuts at the meeting, so they were happy. And I really liked the people in AA meetings much better than my family. So I thought bringing my kids up around them was a much better choice than taking them to my family for babysitting. So I would bring them with me and expose them to the good people in the world, and they loved it. They loved, they're, still friends with a lot of them. The people that I helped get sober, helped my son get sober up in Ohio when he got sober. And my daughter's got 5 years, or four or 5 years now. And it's a family illness, and we I've been trying to warn my granddaughter about it, and she knows. She's been to meetings. I voluntarily mentioned therapy to her the other day, and I was like, you could go to therapy. And she's like, I'm not going to talk to anybody about my She's 18 and whatever. I've moved around a bunch. I've been in a bunch of relationships. There was one that was really, really important to me. This woman really taught me how to love and open up, and she really got inside of me. I had a lot of fucking barriers up from the abuse and trauma, and she broke through a lot of that, and really gave me a a long stretch of really good years with my kids, where I was emotionally available, and she was a good example of how to be a parent, and she taught me a lot. And when that ended, it was devastating to me, and I went through the season of grief that I would go to my father's grave and just cry, and it just opened the floodgates of years of abuse and years of neglect, years of suppression, I guess would be the best way to say it, or try to contain all that emotion, and it all just came out, and I don't know how long it lasted. Weeks. I was there weeks going to the grave nightly and crying. And then one day it just stopped. I went there and there was no more tears. And I was like, oh, I guess I'm done. So yeah, that was really therapeutic for me. I've never been very lucky with therapists. I don't even want to go through all those stories just because I'll just leave it at that. I've never been very fortunate with good therapy people. So yeah, pretty much, I met this friend who did a Native American, spirituality, and she helped me through a lot of stuff, and she was also a therapist, and we did some sweats and Native American ceremony, and we took care of some of it, but there's loads of things I've never dealt with and touched, and they've all been coming up recently, and I guess it's just I'm just stuck in this spot right now, and I don't know how to get out of it, and so I'm thinking that's like the only answer I have left. Yeah, but I was isolated for a long time before Zoom and the pandemic. And when Zoom came along, it re really saved me. I'm mentally ill. I was very sick. I suffered with depression and a whole lot of other things. And me isolating, not going to meetings is very dangerous. And that's where I was when Zoom happened. I just threw myself into Zoom and going to meetings, and you guys got my thinking back to a sober alcoholic's thinking rather than the depression, mental illness, sick, isolated. I don't know what else, how I would describe myself, but it wasn't using drugs, but I wasn't healthy at all. Or drinking, I wasn't drinking or using drugs. But I was isolated terribly. And Zoom just really fucking came along at the perfect time for me. And I really embraced it. I really like it. My kids don't really like it. They don't do the Zoom thing. And I don't really know why, but I would think that their generation would embrace this better than ours. We do. But I just love it. I love having friends all over the world. And I love being able to reach you guys 24/7. I love going to, I just started going to the CA meeting. And I'm not even sure where it is. It's called Out of the Pollution. And it's just fucking hardcore. A lot of new people just coming in, and just the fucking war stories of, jail institutions, and that's the shit I need to remember. And that's the stuff that I know. And we just read, the whole Jay Walker story, and I just love that. That's my thinking completely. And I'm an alcoholic of the common variety. I have a lot of other things that cause me problems, but AA works for me to keep me stable enough to make it through another day, because I do still struggle with depression occasionally. It's like a whole nother disease, man. It just gets on top of me before I even realize it, and it changes my thinking completely. And that it's just it, that worries me a little bit, these complete mental thinking, thought pattern changes are a little alarming to me. It's amazing at the same time and baffling. It's like now I know why it was so hard for them to get AA started, and why we baffled all those doctors, because there were people that really sincerely didn't want to drink, and they would just find themselves drunk over and over and over again. And that's my illness. That's my thinking, or lack of thinking. The lack of judgment. So yeah, I have a healthy respect for the illnesses I have, and I try to stay tuned in as much as my illness lets me, I guess would be the best way to say it. Obviously, I'm struggling right now, and anniversaries are never easy. It's just that I definitely have a shit of judgment where I should be in life, you know. And but then Nana came in, and you know, Nana always says it's okay to be me, and it's okay to be you. Thanks, everybody. I'll stop there.